It's now time to think outside the box of what we've always known.
I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord.
I think that's a profound turning point in somebody's relationship with God.
And our hope in starting this was that this would become an ever-expanding conversation.
Just two real guys talking about life. That's a nice tagline.
I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Brad Cummings.
And welcome to another edition of The God Journey.
So did you run into any more bears this week?
Well, as a matter of fact, you came and stayed with us.
You got a couple of bears lurking around the house?
I'm kidding. No, we've had some great friends show up, and so we've had kind of a wild weekend chasing them around the world.
And well, who are they? You kind of gave us a little excitement here.
You got excited just over
Yes,
that?
I did, just over that.
Okay, no, I think we said last week we're going to have a couple of friends coming through from Australia on the first leg of a...
These are not just a couple of friends. These are like really dear people to you.
They were before they got here.
Oh! They've offended you as house guests, have they?
Not so much offended, but, become part of the... Whatever we...
Yeah, if you stay around here long enough, Wayne smacks you around a bit.
I've told my family, the gift I have is making sure that when people leave, they don't regret leaving.
Well, there you go. Another satisfied customer. We're out of here.
I hate seeing people when they go, we need to leave, it's so sad, all that stuff, so I make it miserable. Yeah, they're gone. They're like... Glad that's on us, on to where we're going next. Oh,
it's something like the fragrant aroma of Christ, huh?
It's not exactly the gift of hospitality.
It would be the anti-gift of hospitality.
It's what the hospitality needs at the end to get people to move on.
I help you leave.
It's what the mother bird does to get them out of the nest. It's what the parents do to get teenagers to go away. That kind of stuff.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Gift. But anyway.
Well, I just haven't read about that.
Now, so joining us tonight, we've got Kevin Smith here. Hi, Kevin.
G'day there, Wayne. How you
going? Oh, can we use English, please?
He sounds like he's from another country.
I'm using English, you guys aren't.
There's a point to be made there, but let's not play with that. Kevin's been a friend we've been figuring out almost 12 years ago. We were in Australia, and we'd been talking on the phone a bit before that. We actually met about 12 years ago. And this is a brother who's part of that Australian bit that I talk about with a lot of folks, learning the cross anew, seeing community in a way that was inspiring to my life at that point. And we were at a very low ebb. It was also a very healing time for Sarah and I being there, even though it didn't complete a lot of healings. It started a few. It took a while to settle in. So Kevin and his wife Val, although she's not with us tonight for the podcast, but they're traveling through the area. So we get a chance to cross paths again, which we've done really frequently in the last 12 years. We've been able
we
to
have.
Be at different places in the world. So
yeah.
So what are you doing on this trip? You're headed from here through to the U.S., through to Europe and on. So,
yeah, we're just dropping in a few places around the world where we have a sense God wants us to drop in, and places where God is at work in his people that we know of, and there's lots we don't know of.
Right.
And our task is really just to go and speak into those situations, things that we think we understand, learn from the situations, things we can learn, and hopefully be encouraged and encourage others.
Ah,
and push on.
That'd be great.
It's a long trip. We'll be away for 13 weeks altogether, and it will tread our way through a range of different situations and cultures. It'll be good.
Oh, that's good. This is one of those kind of friendships that you treasure over a lifetime, I think, even though we've had 12 years at it. But Brad's just meeting Kevin for the first time about an hour ago or less.
I already like him.
You do?
Yes, I do. I like these people. You got some good friends.
I don't understand that part of it either, but I'm grateful for it.
Well, I'm glad they're here to minister to you.
But it's good.
Okay, we're going that way tonight, are we? He warned me.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because in actual fact, within the family of God, the sort of links with people, number one, you meet people quickly and go deeply with them. And secondly, that lasts and doesn't need to be maintained. You know, there's times when I don't reply to emails to you, and there are many times.
Me neither, Kevin. Me neither.
People tell me, they wrote Kevin, I haven't heard back from him. I said, you got to give him 6 months, 8 months, and you'll generally hear back from him, but it's not everybody.
Well, we usually get back, but relationships within the family don't build on what we make them happen. They're based on a reality of a friendship. That's a corporate friendship, and any friend of Jesus is a friend of mine, sort of thing.
Yeah, and I like how you talk about that, because so many times what we seem to do about trying to arrange the body of Christ on our own effort kind of thing is we're trying to make relationships happen, we're trying to build them. But really, and I think this is true in my travels and places I go, when God gives a connection, when it's a brother or sister that's on the journey, this isn't rocket science. This isn't a hard thing to make happen.
No.
In fact, when we try to, it feels a little awkward. You know, I've been to those things now where they do these groundbreakers or whatever the stupid thing they call them, and it just seems so
icebreakers.
And maybe there's a place for it, I don't know, but it always seems so artificial to me.
An icebreaker is really important if the people have got no unity together, no basis for friendship. You know, if you're out of the one family and you meet someone, great aunt Myrtle or, you know, cousin Ernie, and you even if you've not met them before, you're part of them, and something happens where you click together. Yeah, I had experience. My sisters were in Ireland, and they came across some people who were relatives of my father's, and we'd never heard of them before. We didn't know they existed. But when we met them, we walked into their life, and it was like we'd never been out of it.
Wow.
Now, the same thing happens in the body of Christ. I find it over and over again. You walk into places, you meet someone, you go, bang. You're just linked together. And it's not a sort of an exploitive thing. It's something that you just know. Deep inside, there's a reality to it.
And there is a very relaxed, casual nature to it. You don't feel like you're performing, pretending. You don't worry about these awkward silence moments. In fact, usually there's very few because there's such a connection. And, well, what about this? And what have you see there? And, you know, just the getting to know. And I've just never, when people talk to me, you travel over, you get with strangers in the cars at airports. And how do you keep that going? And it's never been difficult.
Yeah, you don't keep it going. That's the point. It keeps going because it's real. You see, the life of Christ flows through us. And the whole idea is he'd come and live in us. And so if he does, I'd expect that if he's in me and he's in you, that we'd have some sort of measure of common unity or community. And so therefore, and that's what we're experiencing when we get together like that, a sense of community that really you just know you're in a place that's right, that you fit in with.
Yeah, we told part of your story, Kevin, a lot. You were on, gosh, we had a tape that I did with you in Australia probably 3 years ago now, and we used it on one of the previous podcasts. Told a little bit of your story, but let's go back and pick up some of your story, because I think people who've joined the podcast since or haven't heard that one would really benefit from knowing a bit of your journey and how you got to where you are.
Well, I suppose the starting point for us was 40 years ago when we were newly married. Belle and I had been married, and we were working for a institutional church doing youth work, and they sacked us. Threw us out on air here. Said we'd stolen.
Do you know what
things.
That means?
Yes, yes. Personally, I do.
You've had some experience with it.
I've been sacked as well. Thank you.
Yeah, I have too.
Anyway, we left the situation, and God amazingly looked after us. We in a miraculous way, we were in a church house, and we were given a house and a place to live. Everything happened in no time, and we found ourselves on our feet and saying, God, you're wonderful. I sat down one day, and I thought, well, you know, God is wonderful. The way he does is just like the perfect father. That's who he is. And some of his people are fantastic. But the system just stinks. It's rotten through and through.
And now, what do you mean by the system?
Well, that thing that sort of holds things together and controls them in such a way to sort of try and keep the religious thing bound up in an organization that keeps working in one direction. The lovely part about the body of Christ that I've discovered as I've gone along is God calls us to live under him and to be committed to him and to trust him to give us the unity and the togetherness that we need. The institutional system said, no, we've got a set of ways of doing things because we found them safer this way, and we do it this way, and you'll do it this way, and this is what happens. And I'd grown up doing that, and that didn't worry me. But I felt that it was very unjust what had happened to us, and we went away and thought about it, and we didn't go back to church as an institution again until quite a number of years later when I was asked if I'd be the Baptist minister at a little place called West Hawthorne. And I thought, oh, I could never do that.
And you never been Baptist before?
Well, I hadn't been Baptist before, and in fact, I thought, I can't do that. But I had a sense God said do it. So we said, we bit the bullet and said, all right, here we come. And we went along, and for 18 years we worked there and watched God do some lovely things, but we experimented about in living under Jesus on the edge of the institution. And, you know, we'd get mailings from the institution and we'd file them in the waste paper basket, and we take little notice about the whole institution. But we lived as an organism together, and God gave us a wonderful life together. And then one day, as we began to read the scriptures more and more, we came to a point where we saw that there's stuff in 1 Corinthians, especially about, you know, people saying, I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos, and we thought, that's a bit like saying I'm of this group or that group or another. And we began to say, and perhaps in a little disrespectful way, say, well, we talked about the fact we're part of God's church, but we're not necessarily wanting to be part of these individual clubs, which are clubs of people, some of whom belong in the church, there's no doubt about it. But the fact was, the church, the club rather, got in the way of actually living under the King, under God. And so we sat down and prayed about it and thought about it, and as a church said, as a whole group of people said, we've got to move. And one of the brothers said, listen, as we prayed, we asked God what to do, and God gave us some pictures, some visions, and we said, we've got to move out. And then another brother said, you know, as I pray about this, he said, I think that you and Val and the family, you guys should move out first, because you've always led us as a pastor. And he said, no disrespect, man, but that's what I think you should do. So, yeah, well, that sounds right, because God had already told us we should move, but we were waiting for him to confirm it, and this was that confirmation. So we moved out, moved up out into the hills, and where we set up house and lived, and wonder what we're going to have, going to happen next. And in fact, slowly, the whole church, as we knew it there, went in different directions. Some stayed, but the whole thing, people went into different places and have walked with God from that point on. And we all know them all still.
And how long ago would this have been? This was years and years ago.
Yeah, it's 20 years ago.
Okay.
And the interesting thing is there is love between the people who were there, both the ones who stay there now and the ones who went out. And there's a relationship that just hasn't gone away. In the last few weeks, we've been to two weddings and a funeral. And
that sounds like a movie title.
Yeah, I thought it would take up some time. But we haven't had. There's been a terrific sense of friendship between the people who haven't seen each other for ages, who were part of that time. There's something that's been birthed there, you can see, and it was part of the familyness that, in spite of our differences, still underlies our lives today. And to me, as I wander around, I find people in all sorts of places that, you know, I don't necessarily think I'd be very comfortable to live, but I love them as people who belong to Jesus, and I find I have a unity with them that we just steer clear of the rubble of organization, the rubble of control, the rubble of rules that men set up, rules of places where the traditions of men become more important than the commands of God.
Yeah, we're getting seriously close to some cow tipping here, aren't we?
Go right ahead.
No, let Kevin do it for me tonight. That'd be much easier.
Well, and the exciting thing is, years and years ago, I remember Blake over here in the States talking about people belonging to God's forever family. And there's a sense of that which I think we experience as the people of God, and that and certainly as we wander around the world, that's the thing we find again and again. We're part of the same family, and any friend of Father's a friend of ours, and we hope will be a friend to us.
Nobody can kind of kick you out of that family. They can revoke your club membership.
Absolutely.
But they can't kick you out of God's forever family.
That's exactly right. And in fact, you know you're there only because Father's Father. Yeah. You haven't got any ticket that says you're part of it. And in fact, God knows those who are his, and he's actually not telling. And we know it because we have a relationship with him, and in that relationship we feel secure.
Yeah.
Fabulous place to stand.
You know, when you try to manufacture that, you know, we were talking earlier about expectations. One of the constant desires I hear out of some people is, you know, they're looking for a relationship. And I understand that. But as I hear the two of you talk, there's the dynamic of just simply receiving the relationship that Father establishes.
Yeah.
As opposed to going with my set of expectations, hoping that my expectations will be met by these strangers surrounding me.
Or trying to build a friendship with somebody. I mean, there's a lot of angst out there. Yeah, people feel I'm lonely, so I'm going to go out and try to get these people to be my friends. And actually, the very act of that distorts the process from the very beginning.
You're right. And what we see is that the problem is a little bit like we're dealing with the fruit on the sideboard, not with the reality. You know, the interesting thing is that, you know, people often say that you might buy a house and there's fruit on the sideboard. It's a little bit added. Often we're more concerned about that than the real buying of the house. You see, in the end, one of our great dilemmas is that most of our thinking, most of our faith even, and our life, and it sort of marks modern man's life, is tied up with this me-centeredness. I'm the center of the world, and what can I get out of God? I've got some problems, I think I'll come to God. Big deal. Come to God because he is. He's the one who created you in the first place. You belong to him by sovereign right. What are you going to do? You're going to sort of say, well, now I'd like this. He answers, no. You come and say, Lord, I want to live in your family your way. And so it's not what I can get out of it. It's just who you are and what you desire, because actually I found your desires and what you like are much better than what I like, and much better than what the club's like, and much better than what the whole world system likes. So,
and very different from all those.
Very things. Different from the lot.
Yeah. And so what are you finding on the show? You talked earlier about, and there was a lot of change, even when you were still part of this West Hawthorne club, there was a lot of changes you guys already made inside of that, trying to, I don't know what you're trying, but just responding, I guess, to what God was about. Ways you decentralized, ways you encouraged family, ways you did away with Sunday school, some of those things. So it wasn't just cold turkey out from more of a structured way to totally unstructured.
We didn't even know we were going anywhere. We weren't in a movement. You know, I don't.
You like movements, do you?
I like them at certain times of my life.
we probably shouldn't go there. We probably shouldn't go there.
That prophetic thing we were talking about earlier.
What pathetic. the important thing to see is that living in friendship with a king is really like living in friendship with each other. Living in friendship with each other is modeled on living in friendship with a king. And the fact is, his desires and what he thinks are important are the ones that become important for me. And I sometimes find, I'm surprised to find that they're much better than anything I ever thought they were, or than anything I ever thought would be good. And so therefore, as I push along, my task is to be able to find ways to be able to be the people God wants me to be. And so that entails listening to him and saying, oh, Lord, what do you want me to do here? And so one of the things we did in Hawthorne, we had this sense, there was lots of people who are unemployed, young people unemployed, and we had this idea we should do something about it. And we said, what do we do, Lord? And we had a sense we should care. And we kept on saying, well, we think God cares, and so we should care. And said, yeah, that's right. And so we got all the kids who are unemployed, all the people who didn't have jobs, and said, why don't we get together and do things for people who need it? So we said to all the social workers in the town and anyone who was in a sort of helping situation, if you know anyone who's got a need, tell us about it, and we'll come and give it a hand. And we did it for 3 or 4 years, where these youngsters would go around and do little jobs around the place, and sometimes they were terrific, simple little things. Sometimes they were quite large. We made some blunders. I mean, one time we got sent to... an old guy asked us if he'd come and cut down a tree, and the guys went around willingly and cut down a tree, but then they found out it was in the wrong yard. They got the wrong address. There were some blunders, but actually, in the whole of it, there was enormous joy in learning to serve and learning to do something that God said to do, even though we couldn't see how it would be evangelistic or how it would be maybe impress people nicely. It most probably didn't impress too many people, some of them especially.
But the guy who lost his tree.
Yeah. But the intriguing thing about it was that the process of it, we learned to live out there, and then at a certain time it seemed like it was over, and then say stop. And see, I reckon that we're not very good at stopping things, because we often start them and the thing gets a life of its own. And we said, no, it mustn't do that. It must be in a bit. We've got to do things in response to the king. So I expect that God's life will be as vibrant, leading us to do things today and tomorrow till it ends, and then you stop it and you'll move into the next thing. And you'll do things all the time that see the significance of the people God's made them, enable people to see themselves who really glorify God by making the decisions that they're free to make.
Well, which is really different from, I think, what most people think. Most people who are trying to have a ministry or do something significant with God, they don't think in terms of, what is he asking me to do today? We really think in terms of, what kind of ministry do I start so that 4 years, 5 years down the road, I can be doing the things I really want to do or that I think God wants me to do. But it's very different than the taskness of, let's just wake up and be part of whatever God asks us to be part of and not look for those things to be permanent.
Well, see, they're all part of the thing of me-centered. My ministry. No, there is no ministry like that. Ministry, you use that way, is crazy. I like to think, God's given me a little job to do today. I'll go and do it. I'm wandering around the world with my wife, believing God called us to do it. I've got a little job to do. He said, I want you to go. We got off our tails and started to organize to catch a air ticket to come. doors open for all sorts of things to happen. We still don't know where it's all going to lead us, but I know he will because our experience is he does. And I could make it nice and comfortable for us by having it secure and have the right number of days off and the right things to do this and the right things. But I've actually learned not to, and to trust him with my life and my days off and my relaxation and my body and my health and all that sort of stuff, and walk through it and come out of it saying, I knew you'd do that, Lord. And to me, that's the sort of stuff we tried to do at Hawthorne. We struggle with saying to people, well, look, you guys take a lead in this. So, I mean, we went from being a little formal Baptist church where I stood in the front like a driver in a tram and said, fares, please, and they took up the offering.
Fares,
please. And they used to ring a bell at the end, like a tram in Melbourne. But also from there to, we gradually moved to a wider range of music, to a wider range of things. We went and threw out the pews and got some seats. We did all sorts of things. Everyone was in agreement. We talked, well, I suppose we talked them into it a little bit. But we went along and gradually we learnt together to trust Jesus and to have confidence that he was leading us. And he has, and he does, and he keeps on doing it. And so that effectively, Hawthorne gave us a chance to try those things, to have... We had most probably a couple of hundred people, a bit more, and most of them met in little house group things around the town, and different people in those house groups took a lead in them and made sure they happened, and they weren't checked up on or weren't ridden, in any way directed from, well, they were a bit directed to the start off, but as it went along, we took our hands off more and more, and it was a joy. And in fact, you know, the life of the thing caught the attention of our locale, and I went back to Hawthorne a few months ago, and an old guy was walking down the road. He said, "Ah, gee, they were the days when you guys were around here. Remember when all the people were wandering around the place, and remember when we'd he wasn't a Christian, wasn't part of the church at all, but he just loved the life that was there because he saw a life." And he says, "Oh, you know, they were the days." Now I said, "No, they're still the days, but things are changing. The world's changing. You've got to see that and roll along with it." But for him, they were high points in his thinking. No high points in ours too, I tell you.
Yeah, but they're not the kind of good old days back there, because you've gone on to live.
They're the good new days right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
I just think of people listening in to what you're talking about, and the way you talk, it makes it sound like, oh, it's just easy. You just follow what the Father is doing, and kind of knowing you just for a few minutes, I'm pretty sure it is that easy. But what do you say to someone who says, you know, kind of a little skeptical, like, it just can't be that easy? You, I'm sure you've run into that mindset.
Sure.
Speak a little bit to that.
Well, I reckon that the thing that I'd have to say to that is the thing that says, listen, do you know him? Do you know him? Is there bulldust in your life? Is there stuff that's crap, not true in you? If there is, deal with that. Because your own hang-ups get in the way of you being able to listen to anyone. If you're upset with your old man and he tries to whisper something nice to you, you don't hear it. Because in actual fact, you've got such a build-up of sort of anger or resentment or something, you won't hear what's being said. And a lot of Christians have never really had the opportunity to live in the vulnerability of having no way out of friendship. And that radical, you know, I remember as a young bloke making a big error. I actually committed a crime, and it was to do with actually borrowing money that I shouldn't have borrowed to do something I wanted to do. And I was in one heck of a pickle. And I said, listen, God, I'm an 18-year-old, you know. I say, Lord, I've made a mess here. What do I do? And I had a funny idea come to my brain, and I decided to do it. I went and talked to the bank manager. The last person I should have talked to, because it was him who handled the money. He sat down with me. He said, "You only got one thing to do. You've got to set it right." He said, "Now, how can we help you?" And so he said, "Well, I don't know. I have to sell the piece of equipment." Now, the irony was, I walked out thinking, "Well, that's helpful to know. What do I do now?" And I went along, and I had to ring up a friend, and I told this person, an older lady, what had gone on, and she was a leader of a youth group that I was involved in. And she said, "What have you got?" And I told her. She said, "That's extraordinary. I've got someone here who's just talking about buying one of those. I'll put them on." So this lady came on the phone and said, "Yes, it does such and such, and it does." "Yes, it does." She said, "I'll come and look." So she drove straight over, saw it, and said, "I'll buy it for whatever you need." And I watched it happen. And I look back at that as one of the key things of learning to trust Jesus. Because I realized that I had to come clean with him about the mess that was in me. And about, I had to realize that I wasn't a great performer. And I believe one of the great dilemmas most Christians have, and anyone asks that question, well, how do you do it? I say, if you're asking that question, the only answer to it is, go out and trust Jesus about something.
That's great.
Go and start. You know, kick off somewhere. Because it's when you launch out and trust him for who he is. Isn't that true? When I saw my wife and I decided I wanted to marry her, even before I asked her out, really, I saw her and I thought, well, I'll ask her. And I felt, I said, God, what do I do? And I looked at the bunch of dates on my desk and there was a little line on the bottom of it, you know, those little wise sayings, and it said, faint heart never won fair lady. And I knew that was God speaking to me saying, get on the phone and ask her. So I did. And the rest is...
She's
still with me.
That's fantastic.
Now, and I think that's what it's like to trust God. You step out in what he shows you to do, and you step out gently, not to push it into happen, to make it happen or manipulate it into being, but to actually take the risk of perhaps even being wrong. The more you do that, the more you grow to trust him. The more you get to trust him, the more you want to do it. And then you've got to control, you've got to be able to be disciplined enough to say, no, Lord, I'm not going to do it because I think that's a good idea or we did it last time. You know, I don't think God does things a second time for fun. I think he always calls you to something new. And that's one of the things we did at Hawthorne too. We said, it's funny how we as churches often say, well, didn't we have a good time doing that outreach thing in the street last week? We should do it again next year.
Why do you think that is, that we do have such a desire to kind of do the things that we thought worked? It's like God does seem to be doing something new and inviting me into something different all the time, and yet so much of the structure, so much of the system is always trying to do what's quote worked for them, and it doesn't work the second, third, fourth time.
Well, it might even work the second, third, or fourth time, but there comes a point. I had a discussion with some folks in Alaska. There comes a point at which this becomes a weekly thing, and it doesn't take long. It doesn't take even probably 4 or 5 or 6 weeks where people start feeling like, oh, crud, it's that night again. And all of a sudden, what we were doing because there was impetus from the Lord and an excitement about, now we're doing it because it's the new routine.
Expectation.
Absolutely.
And then one couple especially was saying they were doing this house church thing, and they got everything ready, and it was a house church, and I got everything ready, and got over there, and four of the couples didn't show up, four of the key couples. And
now they're mad.
And yeah, because they were on all a date night. Yeah. And they were thinking, God, doggone, I wish we'd have known, because we'd have gone on our date night. And I think that's the kind of thing that happens with routine. No matter how good it is at the beginning, how even good it might be the second or third time, there comes that fade-off when it's just us carrying on what God's no longer about. And wouldn't that be a lot of what the rituals and the programs of the institution do, in the long run, which bore people to tears?
Yeah.
Well, there's two things. On one end, they're often meant by people, they say, look, we know it works, it's safe. Whenever you hear the word safe, I think you've got to really take a deep breath and say, what are we doing? Because life isn't safe, and life with God isn't safe either. And then the second thing, in fact, dear old John Wimber used to say, faith is spelled R-I-S-K. And that's true. When you trust God, there's a level that of apparent risk. There's no risk, really, but it feels like there is. And then the third thing that's true is that when we do things again and again, we begin to go through the process rather than actually do the thing. And in fact, it's when you're going through the process, that's when it loses its significance and its meaning. But most of all, God isn't uncreative. He's the center of all creativity. And anything that's vandalizing that creativity comes from the enemy. God is never into vandalism. And the vandalism of relationships, the vandalism of how people meet, the all those things are not his work.
I was thinking when you said that of people who want to learn to live in trust, and yet so much of the way we order our society is to avoid the very risk you're talking about.
Oh, yes.
It's boy, if I do something risky, that's bad, so I won't go there. And maybe that's why people have a hard time saying, well, I don't know that God leads me or speaks to me and talks to me, because my presupposition is, if it's unsafe, it can't be godly. If it doesn't appear safe to me.
That's right.
And even the whole bent, I know people get I know maybe we'll talk about this more later, but I know you and your wife live a real relational expression of the life of the body. You don't have a regular meeting, you porta, a formal thing you go to, but you live it from relationship to relationship and in the network of relationships that God kind of puts together. And you've got a whole group, a whole wing of the family saying, you gotta be in one of those things every Sunday or you're at risk, you're in danger. And it starts really from building that basis of vital, on fear.
Absolutely. And in fact, it's really a lack of faith. Now, faith isn't something you can build up in yourself. Faith is something that is an active thing. Faith is putting trust in the person. I hate the word faith. People say, have you got faith? I say, no. Look, all I do is I trust Jesus as the person that he is, and I find that when I trust him, he pops ideas into my mind at the right time. He gives me something to read today that someone asks me a question about tomorrow. He helps me meet someone who's just the right person to open the door to do a particular thing that he wants done that I'm not even sure of, and yet it comes together. And really, trusting Jesus is really an active living thing, and it's nothing to do with religion. It's nothing to do with religious thought. You don't have to know the Bible to be able to trust God. You don't, you,
wow. I mean, okay. I just heard that one.
There
too.
Goes another cow.
Yeah. Sorry about that, but the fact is, the God of the Bible is someone who calls people to relation with himself and has, through Jesus, opened a way for us to be able to know him in an intimate and clear way that affects all of life. And the Bible is wonderful because it gives us a magnificent picture of how God reveals himself. However, you don't need the Bible to be able to trust him. You need an encounter with him. And in fact, that isn't up to you anyway, because he calls you. He said, you know, you didn't call me, I called you. He said, you know, I'm the calling bloke in this show. And so therefore, if you're hearing me, live your life and you'll be able to know the reality of it. Now, that won't mean you won't study the Bible. You want to. In fact, if you love someone, you want to read their book, their letters, don't you? I once travelled around Australia with an old guy and away from my wife or my fiancée then, and she used to write me letters. And I used to sit on the stage looking like a really religious person with my Bible, but in the Bible I had letters from Val. And I'd sit there reading letters from Val during the time he was preaching. Because to me, to read her letters over and over again were a great joy. And really, reading the Bible is the same thing. It's something you think, this is what Father's got things to say. And so you say, I don't have to do it because I've got to, you know, it's the rules. But I want to do it because I love him. And so therefore, there's a sort of dynamic that's built into it.
Well,
a family dynamic.
From agenda, and the motivations are just out of a response in your heart.
Exactly right. And, you know, you find any young bloke who's just fallen in love with a girl, maybe he's engaged, he's walking around the place saying, oh, fantastic. Now, you know, you say, okay, are you going to play football this week? Yeah, I might, but I'm going to go and see her. And you know, you realize that the motivation of love in that, which may also be a, sort of a sexual thing too, to be honest. But
really?
Yeah.
You
but
think that happened?
Oh, I think God made it to.
Yeah.
So therefore, it ought to be there. But in actual fact, in that whole thing of love and cherishing and all the sort of stuff that's involved in it, it takes his attention off the other things and puts them on that. And so that, I mean, one of the things we discovered at Hawthorne was that when something was happening and when God was doing things amongst us, we saw, wasn't there anything you could sort of write home to Mother about, but there was a dynamic there and people just wanted to be together. So when we got together, we got there, and no one had to say, who's not here today? We'll have to check on these people. We wanted to be together. And if someone had something else, they'd say, oh, sorry, you've got to do that. Anyway, go and do it. Can we help you? You know, but we're going to be together. The dynamic's different. And I think that's true of this whole business, that if you're going to live under the King, you're going to know Jesus as your Savior and the one who brings you into relationship to him, you start off there, and then everything else falls in its right place. You don't learn to know Jesus through reading the Bible. It's a mistake of religious instruction in schools and things like that. You learn to know Jesus because he's who he is, and then the rest falls into place. Like you didn't get to know your Auntie Mary by reading about her in a book. You got to know her because she encountered your life. And then you might have wanted to get a lot more to know her a lot more, but primarily the relationship preceded the data. You don't educate people to Jesus, that's for sure.
I think that's where so many people have been shortchanged, because the system basically says, well, here's all the data, and it assumes, well, of course, you've had the encounter. See, you have all the data, so that's the encounter. And you're just going like, no, they've missed the mystery of falling in love with him.
Absolutely.
And there is no tractor beam on their soul. They have the tractor beam of other people's expectations, the performing for the leaders, and I don't want to disappoint people, but there isn't life in any of that.
No, because in actual fact, it's not real. It's not true. It's not, you know, reality and truth are the same word, the same idea, and he is truth. And so therefore, you know, you don't have to play games. And see, many people I come across have been educated into knowing Jesus in some way or other, and then they've gone along trying to feel the emotion and hoping that it'll become a reality. And often, they just become bitter because they say, this is bulldust.
Bulldust?
Yes.
Okay, got it.
Well, so oftentimes, even people's desire to try to hear the voice of God isn't so much because they're in love and just want to rejoice in that encounter. It's that they're trying to mitigate risk.
Mm.
It's like somehow I want to guarantee that if I'm going to go and do this, that if I can think that it's God who told me to do this, well, then there won't be any risk and there won't be any downfall. And it's kind of like, excuse me? That's not the guy I know.
No. And the fact is that with God, you see, there's no risk because he's satisfied. You know, because of Jesus, he says, look, Kevin Smith's all right. Brad's all right. Wayne's all right. And you say, well, do they always perform perfectly? No, but God says, I'm satisfied. Jesus has died for him. Everything's okay. Now, get on with it. So that instead of trying and you know, it's really a matter of saying, well, yeah, if you're who you are, I'll trust you. Here we go.
And there's no shortcut other than doing it.
No, exactly. Well, until you take an action where you bite the bullet and act, you never know it.
It's almost, I guess, the fear, at least as I talk to a lot of people about this, that really have a hunger to know God's love, real hunger for an encounter, but aren't sure they haven't had it yet, or don't know how to make it happen, or had it a long time ago, feel like I'm not living in it today, kind of a thing. Is, I think one of the things that underlying, maybe this is the backside of risk.
Hmm.
It's that illusion of control.
Hmm.
That if it's belonging to the system, or believing to that creed, or fitting into that hole in the machinery, then I'll be okay and I can control that. And this idea of an encounter with the living God and believing him, trusting him, living under his care every day, that's got my lack of control written all over it. And I think that's the hardest thing to get people to understand, is a big piece of this journey.
Is laying that down.
Is God, destroying your illusion of control. Because you never were in control to start with. Even when you jumped through all your little hoops, God never responded on the backside of those things like we're taught he would. We're just told that because we've done them, you're okay. And we have to keep convincing ourselves of that, because in fact, we don't have the sense that we're okay and that we're living in that care. And so I think it's really the losing, you gotta lose that illusion of control to just say, God, I want to take this risk. I really do want to know you, and I don't want to keep putting all these substitutes around that are actually robbing me. You started this with the structures actually get in the way. And I think this is one of the ways they get in the way, is it gives us that illusion of control. I can make this happen or not. And then the frustration of when I'm doing my hardest and it isn't happening, then there's all that anger either at myself for not doing enough or God for not coming through. And I think that's part of what's really dying in people that are really struggling to get to a place of just saying, I want to wake up today and I just want to live in the care of the Father. And I want to put myself in a place, not where I have everything lined out so I'm okay, but I'm willing to be in risky places to see God make himself known.
Mm.
And that's what scares people, I think. We've been taught to avoid that.
Sure. And the key is that you know, he won't put us in a place where we'll be tempted above what we're able, scriptures tell us. And that's exactly right. He'll never ask you to do what you can't do yourself, what you can't do with his power working in you. He'll never put you in a spot where you're in too deep a water to be able to move. And the fact is that things often look like that.
Yeah, they often do. It's always like that Peter thing with we've left everything to follow you, and Jesus, well, you haven't left anything.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Kind of on the one side, saying that seems awful risky. It is till you get in it.
Yeah,
and then in the middle of it, you go, it's not risky at all. I'm in his hands.
No.
He's got more ways to resolve this than I could possibly conceive.
Yeah.
And it's getting into that flow of what he's doing, rather than trying to get God to do the things that I think he should.
Well, so oftentimes the fear of something almost always is worse than the thing itself.
Yeah, that's true.
It's like you're experiencing an illusion, and it seems amplified beyond what you know, and yet reality isn't as awful as my fear of it tends to envelop me.
Our fears are always bigger than that. One of the lines from the Shack is the things that we don't bring to the light seem so much bigger and so much more distorted when they're in the darkness.
Absolutely.
And that's fear. Fear absolutely sums that up, I think.
And so oftentimes in this whole idea of trying to decide, like, how do I take a step out on the water, so to speak? Well, we're sort of envisioning that we're by ourselves. And that's absolutely terrifying. And it's like that future is about as false as a future imagination is going to be, because I'm not by myself.
Yeah. But see, the interesting thing about all that is that's all talking about people diving further than they know. And I say, just trust God where He's called you to be. He'll never take you above what you're able. So therefore, where He calls you to live today will give you the confidence in His person working in you, and to the fact that He doesn't leave you by in a mess. He cares for you through it. Cares for you through it. You'll be able to have confidence to take the next step. Yeah, our confidence in the Father is just grows because we live in it.
What I hear from you is you're bringing people back to this moment, not some future one that you got to be afraid about. It's like, you know what? We're not there yet. Live with just what's in front of you today, and that you know, in spite of our control and illusion of it, today is kind of manageable. I'm at least here. I don't know what tomorrow is going to be like. I'm not there yet.
And he's here too, and he's not there yet.
That's right.
Yeah.
He ain't finished yet.
Thanks for traveling with us today on the God Journey. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd appreciate your comments or your questions by email or at our website, thegodjourney.com. Stop by today and join the conversation.